Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey hustlers, we know that this 2024, the entrepreneurial journey is filled with challenges. An often overlooked aspect is the time-consuming task of processing payroll and managing government requirements. And did you know that the average admin spends a whopping 50 hours per month dealing with just government compliance? That's time you could be spending on growing your business, or let's be honest, taking a well-deserved break. But fear not, we got a game changer for you. Introducing Sprout Solutions and their tailored solutions for MSMEs called the Payroll Starter. With Sprout Solutions Payroll Starter, you can finally reclaim your time and get your life back on track. Say goodbye to the stress of remembering tax dates or worrying about missed payroll runs. This bundle is designed to make your life easier and your business more efficient. And here's the best part. The cost starts just at 5,000 pesos per month for businesses with up to 10 employees. Yep, you heard that right. That's just 5,000 pesos per month. So why spend another minute drowning in payroll paperwork when Sprout can revolutionize the way you manage your payroll and government requirements? Take the first step towards a more efficient business today. Visit sprout.ph/payrollstartermonthly5k. If you missed that, don't worry. We have it in the description box of this episode, so click that too. And again, big shout out to Sprout Solutions because your time is too valuable to be spent on paperwork. Reclaim it with their Payroll Starter. Now let's begin this episode.
The Hustle Share podcast is brought to you by Uno Digital Bank, a full-spectrum digital bank licensed and regulated by the Banco Central ng Pilipinas, or BSP. Manage your money and maximize its potential growth with a secure and trusted bank that fits right in your pocket. Open a savings or time deposit account. Pay bills. Shop with the Uno Virtual Debit MasterCard or apply for a loan in the Uno mobile app today. And brought to you by DragonPay. DragonPay is the pioneer in alternative payments in the Philippines. DragonPay is the reigning fintech of the year in last year's Philippine Fintech Festival. Sign up now at www.dragonpay.ph.
I never go into business without someone commercial on my side. So when we came back to the Philippines, I was like, let's make sure that we get a commercial co-founder who knows how to set up the business, do the deals. I think my biggest lesson there was like, bring people in who can really supplement those areas where you're weak. Because what's the point in having fun building tech when you can't sell it?
Welcome to Hustle Share, the podcast that features the daily grinds of unique hustlers around the world to show not our differences, but that our hustles are very much alike. Now here's your host, Ronster Baitiong.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Hustle Share podcast. The stars have aligned. We've been trying to do this for a while. Shout out Bobby. Finally, we got this done. Shout out Miss Agnes, who's been giving me the look like, why haven't you had Gina on the show yet for a while? And of course, shout out to my lovely wife, Noreen. Again, it didn't have to take three tries. It's just that we are all hustling like crazy in these day and ages. Because again, it's a rough world. It's a rough startup world. And it's not like there's a lot of money flowing around. So you got to hustle where you can. But again, without further ado, this is long overdue as well. Let's welcome to the show the founder of Connected Women, Miss Gina Romero. Woo-hoo! Gina, welcome to the show.
Wait for you to say my name like that. I was very excited.
Yep. Yep, that's Michael Buffer in me. Everybody gets through like, wow, I've never been introduced like that, like a freaking boxer at all. Again, thanks for being on the show. Finally, we got this done, right? I always say it. People always say like, how come Ron never gets me on the hustle? Everybody will be here if you're legit. It's just a matter of time. It's just that, you know, I can only do 52 interviews a year or 54, Sam, or, you know, limited time. But inevitably, if you're legit, you'll make it on the show. I've been wanting to get get you on the show for the longest time and ask you the million-dollar question. Gina, what's your hustle?
Hustle is providing work from home job opportunities for Filipino women in the AI industry. We work with partners, we upskill women from the grassroots and underserved communities, and we give them digital skills and we help them find jobs in the future of work, which is happening already, which is AI.
That is amazing. And again, we've been hearing about the Connected Women for the longest time. And I've come across you several times in events, said hi, hello, in any event where our heads on a swivel majority of the time. So finally, we get to sit down and dissect every single thing. But before we talk about Connected Women and how you help women hustle and get more AI jobs in this day and age, I need you to sit back real quick, Gina, because we're going to have to go all the way back and understand Gina before Connected Women, because we're going to have to ride the Hustle Share time machine. All right, there you go. There you go. Now, I want to understand because, again, you have a very distinct accent. I want to understand if this is something you were born with or this is something that also caught on to you the same way with my fake-ass accent that I've learned in the call center, right? But for you, I want to understand where you grew up, because, again, I'm looking at your LinkedIn and it says here that you are in the Abbey School, you're Holy Angel Angeles University Foundation. So this is literally Pampanga, where all the great foods are, technically, every time we go there. But I want to understand what was growing up like, and what is your first experience or first exposure into hustling?
Yeah, well, I have a weird life.
Okay.
Well, first of all, obviously, my accent is also fake. I was born in Porac, in Pampanga.
Porac!
Small town called Sepong Balaon. Mm-hmm. Really, I'm really a provincial girl. But it just so happens that my mom was a domestic worker. So she left her town in the 70s and she went to the UK to be a domestic worker. So that's how I ended up in the UK. Yeah.
Where in the UK?
North London. So if there are any soccer fans, we were right near the Emirates stadium. What?
That is such an amazing place to be. That's where the Premier League technically is, always playing. But I want to understand. So, okay, you've seen hustling and being a domestic worker is one of the like hardest hustles you're going to have to do.
Yes.
I'm raised by a single mom. I'm proud to be an only child single mom combo. So I've seen my mom hustle 9 to 5. She had a day job, but she also had a lot of odd side hustles. Back in her day, it wasn't even called side hustles. Racket. That's what she called it.
Yes.
My racket is this, right? She has a DI and whatnot. But I want to understand, you growing up and see your mom hustle like that. What did you observe and what did you see her do growing up?
Well, I mean, OFWs, right? And especially the domestic workers, the pioneers that went in the beginning, right? The first ones, they're really entrepreneurs, right? Mm-hmm. So my mom's story actually is that she heard about this opportunity to go to the UK. Apparently agency was recruiting, right?
Okay.
And people were like, oh no, that's a scam, right? We've seen so many women from our town go to the airport and just come back crying with their suitcase in their hand.
Oh man.
But my mom was like super determined to go. Actually, she was working on the airbase, cleaning on the airbase.
And in Clark.
Apparently, yeah, that was her first job. And she, you know, coming from a tiny, tiny town. So my mom's family, let me skip back a bit. They're kind of like half, one side is like politicians and the other half is farmers. So my mom came from the farming side, not the politics side. Mm-hmm. So she got this job in the airbase and she was amazed, right? She was looking around everything in the base and saying, how come they've got so much, but we have so little? So, you know, she's ambitious. She's 78 now, by the way, still ambitious.
Shout out, mom. There you go. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yeah, so she had this job. She got, she applied for this job in the UK and she didn't have the money to go there. So her cousin offered to pawn his sugarcane mill to give her the money to go. And she said, what if I get scammed? And he said, I'm sure you'll figure something out. So that's how she ended up in the UK. And you know, there are so many women and men, right? Like our OFWs are really heroes and really entrepreneurs. So that's how my mom ended up there. And then she met my dad in the UK. So my dad is, well, born in England, but the son of European immigrants, like refugees from the war. So both from very humble beginnings. My dad was a mechanic. Okay. So yeah, that's how I ended up in the UK. And I just saw so many Filipino communities. I grew up with Filipino communities and they're all hustling. I think they used to call it kayod, right? When they have to get kayod their, the part-time job.
There you go. Kayod
is still now.
Yeah, right. It's kayod for those people who don't understand. It's technically scrape. You're scraping for, or that's what it translates to, right? So
I translated it wrong. For some reason, I thought you were like carrying something. I don't know why. I must have somehow got the wrong picture.
Yeah. So technically you're scraping for, so you use kayod when you're trying to scrape like a cantaloupe, right? Or in the Philippines, call it melon, right? You make it kayod or the coconut. So it becomes like a long strands of it. So you can put it in a buko juice and whatnot there. So that's what it translates to. But again, super duper inspiring. But when you were, when obviously growing up in the UK, what was it like? All right. You obviously saw the Filipino community, and you're right. The OFWs are technically entrepreneurs because at the core of entrepreneurship, it's about risk taking, right? It's how much risk can you even take? The risk you take is basically putting your whole life on the line, right? You're creating opportunity for yourself. And at the
leave
end of the day,
leave everyone behind.
And leave everyone behind. And also do it for the people you care about. In entrepreneurship, isn't that the game? The only difference is the means and also the glamour of it, I guess. You just don't get to carry the world CEO or founder, but my God, the process and the leap of faith is very similar. Right. So,
well, there's an element of glamour for the OFWs as well, right? Because it looks very glamorous until you're actually there doing the kayak.
Right. Absolutely. And then when everything hits you, but people don't understand just because they're overseas, they think everything's all right until they realize it's not. But Gino, that's what I want to understand. So, growing up overseas, I've seen a lot of Filipinos who had the perspective of growing up overseas and going back home here. I want to understand what that was like. Because again, if you grew up here or you were born there and then you also had to study here in AUF, in the other, what's the other school? In Holy Angel. These are great solid schools in Pampanga. What was that process like? So describe to me what was it like being born there and then also going back here to study.
Well, let me fill in a little gap that. So when my parents were working in the UK, I mean, in the UK, you typically work as domestic worker for like really rich, like, you know, mansions, like millionaires, right? So one of my parents' jobs was actually for a Nigerian millionaire.
Oh.
And he was a self-made millionaire. So he had this fantastic mansion in a street in Hampstead in North London called Millionaire's Row.
Oh,
And he was a real hustler. Okay. I got to do a side story here because he really is a hustler. So he came from a tribe in Nigeria. His father was a tailor. And he realized that all the buttons, you know, like on a suit, all the buttons are like the same. So he decided to import buttons from Italy. Okay. And he started to get rich by doing that. And then eventually he built an empire of all different businesses, like thermos flasks, slippers, pens, everything. So he was amazing. And like he would go to the UK, go to France, go to factories, learn how they were creating products like Bic ball pen or thermos flasks or whatever, and then basically make copies of it for the Nigerian market. So pretty, pretty cool hustle. But you know, I'm an only child like you. And I lived in a mansion. So I had zero friends. I would just read books all the time. Right. But I had this one friend who I met, who's a rich friend, you know, who used to come home during the holidays, and she used to go to boarding school.
Okay.
And I wanted to go to boarding school. I didn't quite compute that it was really expensive and my parents were just domestic staff and couldn't afford it.
Okay.
So I said to my mom and dad, can you send me to boarding school? And my mom said, and my mom is brilliant for encouraging me to do these kind of things. She said, why don't you ask the chief to send you? We called him the chief. So I did. I was like eight, I think, or No, I must have been like 10, I think. And I marched up to him and said, could you send me to boarding school? And he sent me to one of the best boarding schools in the UK.
Wow.
So that's how I ended up in Battle Abbey.
What? That is amazing. All right. Okay. So again, not a lot of people get to, actually, I don't remember anyone that's been on Hustle Share that has been on a boarding school. What was it like in a boarding school? And because again, these early exposures transform us for life. Like, for example, for me, I credit my mom so much. So it's akin to your process. She sent me to a progressive school in grade school here in the Philippines. So the typical education of a Filipino grade schooler is, of course, you go through this. It's a cookie cutter approach. You go through all the subjects, probably go to school, you wear a uniform, that's it. The school that I got enrolled with is an American South school. So we have three subjects a day. We didn't wear a uniform. So it's explain work and experience. So, but I got to hone a lot of the skills that I still probably use at the performing arts, whatever, right? Which I get to use, but my whole perspective is different. And I discovered probably my tendencies and talents very early on. I credit that experience to having a very early sense of self. For you, what was it like?
Definitely.
In boarding school?
Well, I mean, I was like 11, so, and I wanted to go. So, I mean, it was such an amazing experience. So I think there's two types of people in boarding school, right? The ones that didn't want to be there and the ones that want to be there or didn't mind being there because they didn't see anything negative about it.
Okay.
And I was the one, you know, I wanted to be there. I thought it was amazing. So, and it's like, oh, the building is like 1066, right? From the Battle of Hastings. So it's like an ancient, ancient place with like a gate, you know, like the thing, the portcullis thing stops the enemies coming in and the holes in the window where you can shoot the bow and arrow and stuff like that.
That's it was super amazing. Old.
So it was amazing. And, you know, but the thing is they were either really rich people or military kind of kids, you know, because the military will subsidize schools so that the kids don't have to keep moving around with the parents. So, so mainly like wealthy people. So I was like a poor person, right, in a rich school. So that was an interesting perspective. And, you know, so this is the interesting thing when I came to the Philippines, because my parents decided to be entrepreneurs. Bring their savings back to the Philippines and start a business, go back to my mom's town and be farmers. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to have they ended up with a pig farm. And so when we came back, I was super excited about coming back. And then I had to enroll in Holy Angel and everything. Right. I had like a really major culture shock because I came from like this tiny, tiny little school in a castle, in an abbey. And then I went to Holy Angel at the time was huge, you know. I mean, it's still huge now, but it was really, really big and very different mode of teaching. And obviously I didn't speak the language. And I was now the tallest, whitest, richest kid, you know. So the perspective shifted very radically for me.
Yeah, that's amazing. Now you went there, and again, according to your LinkedIn, what technically came after is again, you became the acting manager of the family business. As your first stint. Is that correct? Is that your first hustle right out of college?
Yeah.
What was it like? Right. What was it like?
Pig farming.
Because coming from the UK and doing that.
Yeah, I was still in high school. So my parents had to go back to the UK because pig farming is capital intensive, believe it or not. So I got active in the farm from like 14, 15. I love pig farming. I wasn't told to go and work in there. But I was always, you know, following the vet around, like wandering around in there. I decided that I wanted to be a vet. So I was always hands-on. And I was doing a lot of stuff, you know, in the farm already from pretty young. And then my parents had to go back to the UK because, you know, we were just running out of capital and they were trying to expand to get profitable. So I was pretty much in charge. Like I would sign off the salaries. I would sign off the big expenses. I would sign off sales. So I had a lot of responsibility. And then guess what?
Okay.
And then Mount Pinatubo erupted.
Oh my God. Holy shit.
Yeah. When I was in third year high school.
Oh my God.
And so that added another layer of madness. Yeah.
That is crazy.
So I was there.
Yeah. And again, that everybody got bamboozled because of that. Literally, figuratively. Right. So when that happened, obviously the next thing that happened is the basis. We're gone next. Right? That whole region just basically changed overnight. And again, I saw here before we take our first break, a couple of very interesting things. You became a foreign currency exchange cashier and an FA or air cabin crew cabin services for 10 years in the UK. That's what I want to know, because we're talking about skill stack, right? So you got involved into entrepreneurship very early. When you get exposed very early, that doesn't leave you for long. But again, you've added multiple layers as you went back to the UK. Talk to me about, again, foreign currency exchange cash being in Forex. And of course, 10 years as an FA.
So I was quite happily, in this business, and I wanted to be a vet, and my life was all pretty much planned out in my head at like 15. And then, the volcano erupted and basically everything went horribly wrong, as you can imagine. Yeah. Like we lost the whole business. And then my parents actually sent money to rebuild parts of the business, but then we were not making money anymore, because to come to our farm, you would have to cross over that Lahar, right?
Lahar. The river. Until now, it's still there, actually.
Terrifying. Mm. Yeah. So, so the business basically went down, and eventually my parents said, look, why don't you come back, like, let's just shut it down, come back to England. And I didn't want to go back to England because, I'd spent my, young adulthood in the Philippines. I had my friends there. I had my life panned out. England was very alien to me, at that point. My kabampangan was rocking a bit, I was slightly, I didn't want to go back. But then my parents were insistent that we shut down the business. So we shut the business down. And then instead of going back, I ran away. I actually ran away.
Whoa.
So I didn't go back. Yeah. So I spent some time.
What does run away mean? Like where to where?
So I was initially in a boarding house because I was taking BS biology, right, in AU. And then, so I stayed in the boarding house until I ran out of money. And then I basically just bombed around, and I lived pretty rough, to be honest, for about 18 months or so.
Where?
I lived in some pretty slummy areas
in
Angeles. Yeah, in Angeles. I did some very dodgy, as what we would say in England, dodgy things.
Okay.
Hustled, worked in random places, worked in a karaoke bar. Oh my God, all my truths. Worked in a karaoke bar, did some just bummed around for a bit with friends. I got basically very broke. And then had to call my parents to send me a ticket. I backed myself
that happens,
into a wall.
Right? Very early. And let's just call it what it is. Because everybody goes through this. And honestly, I also was dicking around for a while. And I did this in high school, college. But it never got to the point where I had to leave my mom. But when you fuck around early and you realize you're wrong, that can be the most pivotal moment of how you get your life back on track. If you don't dig yourself a hole too deep that you cannot get out of.
So I almost felt like I was dug in too deep. It was really hard to make that call to my parents because they had been telling me to come back, right? And they knew of where I was and stuff, but I just wasn't really responsive. And then, I kind of went down. You wonder how people run away and end up kind of like homeless and stuff, right? But I can understand how that can happen, because you kind of alienate yourself more and more and more, and then you feel so disconnected that you feel like you can't come back anymore.
Right.
But anyway, I reached out, and then my parents said, come back. And so I went back to the UK. So I was literally sitting on the plane crying because I was like, I don't know what to do with my life. And I saw the stewardess, and then I was like, I could do that. That's how I got the idea, because I had a blank slate, so I thought I could do that. In reality, I hadn't really thought about how difficult it really is to get in, right? But I just thought I could do that. So that was the first thing I did when I went back to the UK. I actually applied for airlines.
That is amazing. Now let's take our first break, and when we come back, we will not talk about life in the UK after almost hitting rock bottom in the young Gina. We'll talk about Gina as she blossomed through her career. And again, also going back here in the Philippines after all of that hustle back in the UK. But let's talk about that more after the break.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey guys, I have a very, very exciting opportunity I want to share with you guys. If you're a B2B startup founder, listen up. Your ticket to growth is here. Introducing Impact 24, the Philippines' largest B2B SaaS challenge. Calling all startups in their pre-launch, pre-seed, or seed stages, this is your chance to accelerate their growth. Submit your pitch to Impact 24 and get ready for a 10-week intensive program to elevate your solution. What's in it for you? How about up to 500,000 pesos in MVP project support, exclusive credits from industry partners, personalized mentoring, and a shot to pitch at SaaSCon PH, the country's biggest SaaS conference this April. But yo, you gotta hurry up because submissions close on January 26, 2024 already. Don't miss out on this opportunity to take your startup to new heights. Apply now at saaschallenge.ph. That's saaschallenge.ph. And good luck, and I'll see you guys in Impact 24. And we're back in the break. We are still with Gina Romero, then is on a plane as we literally took the break crying. And then she had an epiphany when she saw an FA rocker thing. I want to understand, Gina, when you saw the FA and you think we felt like you're just a blank slate, you left your life and you're going back here humbled back to the UK. What did you see in the FA that you felt like, hey, I can do this shit. I can actually do it. Because eventually the fact that you actually took that interview and eventually you did this for 10 years, whew, you must have, yeah. you made the right call, right? So what did you see first and walk me through that process of getting to the airline?
Well, I was literally thinking, what am I going to do, right? You know, when sometimes life just resets you, like Right. Start again, you know, forget everything else that you've done and start again. And, you know, and that's happened to me several times,
right?
But definitely, you know, in that moment, I was drawing a blank. Like I just could see no future ahead of me. And, you know, I said I was crying, right? And this flight attendant pulled me out of my middle seat, probably. And brought me to the galley, probably.
Okay.
And, you know, and she sat me down in her chair at the back of the aircraft and gave me some whiskey. So I must have been, you know, like doing the ugly cry, okay, right? Not just okay. Like at one tear. So, you know, and I felt touched, you know, that she had like made that gesture, right? And
right.
I was kind of like, I sat there for a while composing myself and just watching the crew in the galley, and it looked like fun. Mm. And I thought, you know, I can do that. Like, I like people. I like
sipping,
you know,
on
like the
whiskey.
This.
All right.
Sipping on the whiskey, mm-hmm. Planning out my life.
What a pitch. That's okay. When you had that, and obviously, what was the prep like? Because again, being an FA, There's a glamour to it, but being a frequent flyer.
Oh yeah, it's not glamorous.
Oh my god,
in real life.
It is not. It's not. I was like, wow, this is such a cool thing that you get to travel, but the grind that
you guys do from flight
to flight to flight. Can you describe to me what that grind is like? Because you did that for 10 years. And then what are the skills that you developed over time while doing that?
I learned so much from flying. I mean, when I look back, I mean, at the time, it was just one big party, right? It's like gruesomely grueling hard work, right? And then parties back to back. So it's super fun. I mean, I loved it. I loved every minute of it, almost every minute of it. And I had some amazing advice that helped me, I think, frame myself around the job. So, you know, I think in the beginning when I had started flying and, you know, you're new and you love it and it's so exciting. And this was British Airways, so it was super British.
Uh-huh.
And then after about 6 months, it starts getting kind of hot, you know, like passengers start to be really annoying because they keep doing the same annoying things over and over again.
Like standing up before the seatbelt sign is removed.
All the stuff, stacking up those little cups, you know, like stacking up all the trays so you can't put it back in the trolley and all the things. And, you know, there's a time after about 6 months, I think, where the honeymoon phase is over and you start getting a bit agitated with the passengers and all that. And then I had this, this amazing... So honeymoon was over and I've had so many amazing crew because it's a big crew in Heathrow Airport where I was flying from, around 11,000 crew. So every flight you're with different people. Even after 10 years, it is quite possible that you won't know anyone. So, you know, it was quite, you meet a lot of different types of people and BA recruitment goes through different phases. So there was like in the old days, right, in the 60s, we had like what we called the debutantes. So these were the extremely, you know, posh women who wore gloves and, you know, Audrey Hepburn type, because you had to be a debutante to be crew. And then it moved through, I think they called it the regional accents, where it was because commercial flight became more kind of, you know, like mainstream, right? So they didn't want all these posh birds. They wanted like real people. So they started recruiting from all over the UK. So you had all the different Northerners and Southerners and Irish people. And then my recruitment drive happened to be when they recruited a lot of people from Europe because of like the EU thing. So there's a lot of different people that you meet. So that's always really fun. And then there's people that have really nailed how to live this life, right? How to enjoy it and everything else. And after 6 months, and I was getting agitated with crew, and one of the cabin crew, the senior crew, just said to me, you know, there's only two types of people in this job, the ones that hate it and the ones that love it. And he said, I've been here for like 30 years or something.
That sounds like boarding school as well.
Yes, exactly. Maybe that's a thing in life, right? And I was like, I decided that I was going to be the one who loved it. And if I didn't love it anymore, I would leave. And I think that's how I stayed for 10 years. And I loved every minute. And I decided to leave because I was getting to the point where I was like, I'm not loving it as much now. Right. And I didn't want to be one of the miserable ones, you know?
Mm. So you're still loving it, but not to the point where you despise being an FA. But again, Gina, I want to just track back because 10 years is not, or you loving it meant that you really loved it, right? But what are the indelible marks that being an FA taught to you that you still carry on as an entrepreneur now?
So I was quite senior, as you can imagine, in the crew ranks by the time I left. And so it's very like military style in British Airways. But the more up the ranks you go, the more freedom you have to choose where you want to work and all of this, right? So you've got your economy, your what we call club class, and then first. Ooh, but I always chose to work down the back.
UK. I didn't know.
It used to be, I don't know what it's called now, but it used to be called first. They dropped the class. But I always chose to work in economy. And it was so funny because we would sit in the briefing room before the flight and they'd say, Gina, where do you want to work? And I say, I'll take down the back. And they were like, what? I used to choose the position called F, which is like number 16. And it was normally the one that the most junior crew member got stuck with because you're in charge of like the babies and then the people in wheelchair. And it was like the hardest job, basically the hardest physical job on the plane. But I loved that job because I loved talking to people, like finding out what their story was, why they're flying somewhere. Business class is just people going to work, right? They're not very excited.
Right. And they don't want to be bothered either.
exactly. Whereas down the back, you know, there's always a story, right? A wedding happening or a granny visiting her, you know, grandbaby in Australia or whatever else. So yeah, I just love the stories and I actually love to, you know, do good service and make people happy and all of that. Sounds cheesy, but it's true.
No, but it's again, when you have that gene of service, it never leaves you. So I have a similar experience, but went through my first startup. I was a party boy. I got people in the clubs. And for me, I always get a kick. Yeah, that was my app. That's my very first startup. It's called Party File. Gets people into the guest list of all the nightclubs in the Philippines, right? And our tagline was very straightforward. I remember that it's called Have the Best Night Ever. My job is to get these guys so effed up that they will have the best night of their life. And if I made sure that the day, the morning after is like, oh my God, what did we just do? Or it was just they had a ball, then I did my job, right? Whatever they did inside, that's their decision. My job is to get them in, get them to the table. Up to you. You're all adults here. Okay. I was just the accomplice to get that. But that spirit of giving people a great time never leaves you. And even as an entrepreneur, if you're a giver and you love people bringing together, you love bringing people together and giving them a great time. It transforms in different ways, but that DNA is still instilled with you. Yeah. Now I want to understand from going F.A. Gina, how did it go to IT Gina? How did it get to tech and IT? Because the next stint, again, you did this for 3 years. You were in the Syndicatum, right? An IT solutions
consultant. That was one of our clients, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
How did you get into this from a private global investment bank?
Yeah, so I met my husband. That was the switch. So I didn't even have a computer yet. He loves it when I shout him out. He's a big fan of yours, by the way. He calls
Thank you
a legend.
Bobby. Love you too. You are the legend because you married Gina. There you go. In the bank.
So I met Bobby. And so funny story with Bobby. So, you know, I met Bobby through my dad.
I did not know this. Okay. Again, I'm coming in raw, man. I have no...
Most people don't know this. Uh-huh. So he was coming the other way. So he grew up here in the Philippines and then he went back to the UK because his family had migrated to the UK. Mm. So he followed them and he happened to land in the same town where I lived, Edgware, the unglamorous town of North London. And he got a job in a computer, a small computer shop selling peripherals and accessories and then building computers. And my dad had gone and bought himself a computer because he was always way ahead of me in anything tech, even though he wasn't a techie, but he was just curious about it. Right. And you know, he was kind of a nightmare customer for Bobby because he bought this one PC tower and then proceeded to phone him every day with, you know, trying to do stuff.
Okay.
All the stuff. Like he was always trying to upgrade it and add extra hard drives and install stuff. And he was always breaking it and taking it apart. He was a mechanic, right? So it was in his instinct to break it and fix it again. Mm-hmm. And then Bobby was always going to my mom's house. So I would go visit my mom and then, you know, he was there. I'm like, who's this guy? Why is he always here? But anyway, fast forward a while. And then my dad nagged me to go and buy a computer. He was like, get a computer. You can do email. You can do internet. I was like, I don't need any of those things.
I'm an FA. The hell do I need this for?
Exactly. Okay. So anyway, just in the end, just to shut him up, basically, because he was just going on about it so much. I said, fine, I'll get one. So I walked into the computer shop. And, you know, I mean, Bobby's story is obviously a different version because according to him, my hair was blowing. I had long hair then. My hair was blowing backwards and angels were singing and light was, right, all that. But I was just like, my dad said, I need to get a computer. So I bought my first computer from him. And anyway, fast forward a long time because there was no romance at the beginning. We kind of went through a friendship and went through some stuff. And then eventually we got together. So that's why I got into tech, because my dad forced me to buy a computer from my future husband. Weird stuff.
That is amazing. Again, so that's you. It's your fault, Bobby. You got Gina into the IT realm. So now I want to understand, how did this turn into a career, from obviously buying a computer from a Pinoy as well? But well, how did that turn into a career? Because again, that's quite the shift going from FA to IT.
So he was working in that shop and then he eventually got a shop for a company. So he was driving around different parts of the UK doing sort of IT infrastructure installations and support. And, you know, at this point, we already had I was on maternity leave for second time. So I was actually on a break. I had two breaks during that 10-year flying stint. And obviously, when you're crew, you earn a lot more when you're flying than when you're grounded, because you get your other stuff, right? Or your special stuff, special overtime and all that. So, you know, we really just needed to earn a bit of extra money. So Bobby had the idea that he would buy some laptops from a local classified ad paper and that we would resell them on eBay, because eBay was new. Okay. Initially, we were just buying them from the newspaper and then selling them again in the newspaper, in the same newspaper.
Nice. With a profit now, with a margin.
Exactly. I mean, you could do that then, because people were sort of like, the, you know, the corporate people were starting to sell off their laptops. Right. So laptops were not affordable for most people at the time. Mm. But we were starting to see these people. But the corporate people were just selling them for however much. Right.
Right.
And we realized that if we cleaned them up and did a better description, mm-hmm. Then we could make, we could mark it up, right? Like £50 to £100, I think, at that time per nice. Sale. So yeah, it was pretty good. So we were doing that. And then we discovered eBay. And that was so much fun because, you know, on eBay, you have to bid, right?
Right.
It's like an auction.
Yep. And it jacked up the price.
People were like going nuts.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. Well, no, you just start it at £1 and then people go nuts and then they start competing on the bid.
Correct.
And then all of a sudden they've outbid their competitor, but for some reason they've paid more than market price. So and that was kind
of funny.
The
grand winner is you guys. Refurbishing and just like doing a quick fixer upper.
Yeah, we did all sorts of stuff. We did gaming laptops build to order.
Wow.
That was fun. And then you know, the margins started dropping because you had Dell and all of them doing right. Similar things, right? Making it cheaper and more accessible. And then we moved to services, like, you know, basic home and small business services. Mm. And then we started doing, and that's how we got Syndicatum, was one of our clients. So we had a small office at that point, and then we were reached out to or introduced to a small investment bank that needed some IT support. And so we won that contract. And then they started up a carbon capital trading company, which also became our client, which was also small, but then started to grow and grow. So that's how we grew our business, basically through that, mainly through that one client and few others.
And that's amazing. And if it was really that good and it made you actually leave the and be grounded for life, technically, and without having to go back, what were the very first struggles that you had to go through? Obviously, it's a starting business. Of course, there's a lot of good stuff. But in any new business, struggles. Especially if you're a first-time entrepreneur as your own start, and this is a husband and wife tandem, what were the first ones that you had to overcome? Because it's never easy.
Yeah. Well, the laptop one was fun because we were both earning. So everything we earned was pizza money, right? Pizza and beer money. It was really like, we were like, wow, we can just be entrepreneurs. We should just quit our jobs, you know? Mm-hmm. So when Bobby quit his job so that we could do the IT services and the sales, like obviously it got real because all of a sudden you got to feed yourselves from what you earn. So that was a little bit of a, you know, a bit of a different perspective. But I think one of the interesting things we did, Ron, I forgot to mention it, is before we did the Syndicatum and other clients services contracts, we actually dabbled with Wi-Fi.
Ooh.
So I'd gone back flying in late 2002 and went to New York and saw people using Wi-Fi in a cafe in like Starbucks or something. And there was like a leaflet and it said, you know, the latest T-Mobile is testing the latest cutting edge technology Wi-Fi.
Right.
And so I was so excited. I brought this leaflet home and I said to Bobby, in New York, they have internet without wires. No, like plugging it in and making that horrible noise and all the stuff, right? No fighting over it.
Right.
And so he started researching it and then he started importing all these like different things, right? These different wireless routers. And we were Wi-Fiing our whole street. It was really fun.
Whoa.
And then we hustled with a friend of mine who was cabin crew or flight attendant. And he lived in an apartment built like a university town apartment building. Mm-hmm. And he had flatmates. Right. And we went there one day and I said, do you have internet? And he said, no, we don't, because it's too expensive to get the wired connection. And there's 3-4 of us here. You know, we'd have to take turns. It'd be hassle. So we said, why don't you put Wi-Fi? So we put Wi-Fi, and then what happened is it bled up and down the building. So together with my friend, we started selling Wi-Fi in this residential building, £10 a month. Just knock on the door.
That's amazing.
We had a splash screen, right? Like knock on number 18. And then we were more sophisticated. We had like the codes that you could get. If you phone the number, you get the code. But you know Jay Fajardo, right?
Yep.
So it's so funny because I had drinks with Jay, with Bobby the other night. And it was so weird because we were in some kind of multiverse situation because he was doing the exact same thing here in the Philippines.
Yep.
But
airborne access.
Yeah. But he was successful. We failed. So it was like a multiverse sliding doors scenario where he did really well. And we did it kind of like the wrong way. And so like we had such a big opportunity, but we were so new as entrepreneurs. We didn't know how to navigate it. We didn't have connections. We didn't have funds. So we actually lost like a really big opportunity in putting Wi-Fi into residential buildings because we couldn't fund it.
Got we already it. What had were the mistakes? Yeah, you said that again. If Jay was able to capitalize on Airbar exit, that was his exit. That was a exit moment of Jay. But what was for you guys? In hindsight, what was the mistakes that you guys did that didn't allow you to capitalize on the opportunity?
Yeah, so Bobby and I are kind of like geeks, I guess, right? In our different ways. Like we like making solutions and it's fun for us. And we're also entrepreneurial in that sense. But at that time, we didn't have the commercial acumen at all. So we built that, you know, the one that we were selling in the building of my friend, and the building found out and they called us in. And I thought, oh no, we're going to be in big trouble, you know, because they found out we're illegally selling Wi-Fi in this building. But actually they were like, we're really interested in this. Can you pilot this in one of our new buildings and see if it works? And if there's going to be enough uptake, we'll buy it from you. Mm-hmm. So it was really exciting. And so we had this opportunity to run a pilot in, I think it was like 60 units. And we ran it for 3 months, I think. And we had to get some, you know, feedback from the residents to see if they wanted to buy it and how much would they pay and all this stuff. So, you know, at that time we were like garage entrepreneurs, right? We didn't have an office. We didn't have staff. I was like changing nappies on the floor while, you know, in between flying, and we were selling laptops and all this. So, you know, we were ill-equipped. And so when the pilot was done and it was successful, they called us for a meeting and we sat in a boardroom. I'm not kidding you, with probably 8 directors of this development company, the commercial director, the customer service director, the marketing director, and Bobby and I, right, in our cheap suits with our business cards that we printed on our own computer, you know, on our own printer. Right. We must have looked super green. And then they wanted to talk commercials and we were not equipped to talk commercials. So, but anyway, we managed to get by the discussion, but our idea was that they would pay us £10 a month for every unit in the 200 unit building. And then they would then charge £30 a month, which was the same cost as wired broadband at the time, to each individual unit. So we would get 100% uptake, right? And they would mark up which I thought was a really great plan and a good model for everyone. But it turns out that's not how they operate. So they said, well, no, we've just installed Sky. So can you just sell it to whoever wants it and we won't take any of the money?
Oh, shit.
Yeah, it was not. And we had to install it at no cost. So I was like, I'm not sure how we're going to do that because we're just like 2 people.
Okay.
So we went to the bank manager. Mm-hmm. This is the funny part. And we said to the bank manager, we have this order to install Wi-Fi for 200 units. This is how much it's going to cost. Mm-hmm. We just need the money to install it and then we need to sell it.
Wow.
And he said, and this was like a small business bank manager, right? In Banyake equivalent in the UK. And he said, so explain something to me. I go to work, I go on my computer, I do my work, I come home, I sit at my sofa, I watch TV. And then if I want to do some work, I sit at my desk and do some work. Why would I want Wi-Fi? So we couldn't, they wouldn't lend us the money to put the infrastructure. They just didn't get what we were trying to do and why anyone would need Wi-Fi too early. So that was, but the funny thing is that we didn't even realize that we'd lost a really big opportunity. I think obviously we knew we'd lost an opportunity and we lost a deal, but we were not sort of like super gutted about it. But when I look back, I'm like, wow, if only we knew what we were doing or someone would fund us, could have been sitting on the beach.
But again, hindsight being 2020, The thing about these things about is that the opportunities, these comes in cycles, right?
Oh, yeah.
You miss the first bus, there's always a second and third bus. But again, if you saw the bus already come, sometimes it really haunts you. It's like, shoot.
But we learn from that, right? Like, I never go into business without someone commercial on my side. So that's why in Connected Women, we have Ruth, right? Ruth is my co-founder. So when we came back to the Philippines, I was like, let's make sure that we get a commercial co-founder who knows how to set up the business, do the deals. Right. And then, of course, we brought in Agnes, right, as a CEO, because I'm not operations.
Right.
So I think my biggest lesson there was like, you know, bring people in who can really supplement those areas where you're weak. Because what's the point in having fun building tech when you can't sell it?
Absolutely. That is the core of what it is in startups, because that's one of the things that a lot of people make mistakes with. They build something that they can't sell, or that people don't want, right? And people get obsessed with building product. And then what they don't realize, like, oh my God, well, people even pay for this thing that I've created. So that's the most important
thing. And you don't
thing.
Know, right? You don't Correct. Know if people are not buying it because you don't know how to sell it or if they don't want it. So at least if you have a good salesperson, you know, if they're not buying it, it's your product.
No,
not
exactly.
Your sales.
Exactly. So now what I want to understand, so obviously you did three, what were the next steps? And then we'll do a bit of a fast forward up until you decided that, hey, it's time to go back and get it done. And then go back and actually hustle again. Yeah, correct.
Yeah, so, well, a few things happened. First of all, Bobby was headhunted by our client, that the company that Syndicatum set up in the clean energy sector started growing. They got a big investment. Like huge investment. And so they started setting up offices globally, and then they moved their headquarters from London to Singapore. So that was kind of the first. But, you know, the time that that happened, when they headhunted Bobby, we were almost going to go bankrupt from that business.
Wow.
Because, and it's so funny, right? When you think about people going bankrupt, you always think like, oh, it's because you weren't selling enough, right? But it wasn't the case. Like, we had this one client that had grown so fast that was basically 80% of our business was coming from them. And, yep. And we were getting choked because they were so big and we were like a 5-man team.
Yep.
And then they were ordering like top of the range laptops, servers from us, which we were forking out money.
Mm.
And then, you know, our credit terms or their payment terms were like very comfortable for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's just the way it is when you're a small company dealing with a big company, right?
Yep.
So they became a big company and we started to struggle. And then we were really panicking because, you know, if we lost that client, we would lose everything.
Yeah, there's a concentration risk.
Yeah, so much. And we'd invested like money from our house, you know, like we'd remortgaged our house and put money in,
God,
so that we could cope with their scale and everything. So we were at a point where we were like sweating. I thought I was going to have a heart attack. I was like, God, how old was I? Like younger than 30. And I would lie in bed at night with so much weight on my chest because it was so stressful.
Yep.
I mean, they were just doing their thing, right? Entrepreneurial terror, right? Entrepreneurial terror. I know what it is now, but I didn't know what it was at the time. So, but you know, just what happened was we sort of told them that we weren't able to continue that contract because we realized we were going to lose it anyway. So we'd rather duck out and kind of like hand it over and bring them in a new company that could work with them and figure out what we were going to do next. And then they basically said, no, like, we'll offer you a job. We'll offer Bobby a job as our IT manager initially. And then they moved us to Singapore and he became the global CTO. So that was how we ended up in Asia.
That's amazing. All right. Now, well, back in CTO, okay, you got uprooted. At least now you don't have to worry about payroll and making ends meet and all that.
Yeah.
But what was it like being so close to home, but not quite home yet? What was it like in Singapore? And how did that come to the Athena Network Singapore, APAC?
Yeah, so when I was in the UK, when we were doing this IT business, I joined an organization in the UK called the Athena Network, which is a women's business group. So that's how I ended up in my community building, sort of women's community building side. And the founder became a really good friend of mine. When Bobby got headhunted and I wasn't going there to promote our IT services anymore, I said to her, I don't know what to do with myself now. Like, I still want to do something, but I don't want to start a business. I'm tired, exhausted, but I also don't think I'm employable anymore. So, you know, any ideas on what I can do? And she said, why don't you join me? I'm franchising this network and I need some help to roll it. So she brought me in. I thought I was joining as her sort of assistant or office manager, and she brought me in as her operations director.
Oh.
So that was kind of scary because I didn't know how to be an operations director. But yeah, the franchising component was really interesting. I learned a lot. So when I moved to Singapore, when Bobby was offered that job, I launched the Athena Network in Singapore.
Nice.
Yeah. But to your point about the Philippines, like, I had blocked the Philippines out of my mind, honestly. After I went back, after all the trauma of everything that happened, I had no intention to come back. Yeah, everything, right? Like, the running away, the getting broke, died. You know, I got typhoid. So it was not in my mind to come back. I had settled myself happily into the UK and I'd moved on. But when I went to Singapore, which, as you mentioned, is just like a step away, right? Guess what? Like, I had, because I when we moved to Singapore, I was pregnant with my youngest son, our third son. Mm-hmm. So I had my baby there. And then we had a Filipina yaya. So I was kind of like shocked when I went to Singapore. Like, why do we have so many Filipino domestic workers and yayas?
Why is there so many people in Lucky Plaza eating Jollibee on a Sunday? Mm-hmm.
And why is this still a thing, right? Like, my mom left the country in, you know, the 70s. And I was blissfully ignorant and thought that this was solved now. Because, you know, in the UK, US, you see some mobilization of Filipinos, right? You kind of settle there and you get your citizenship.
Yep.
I didn't realize that this was still happening, honestly. Mm-hmm. So I was very shocked. And the more Filipino women I met in Singapore, especially the helpers and the yayas and all that, I, you know, hear one heartbreaking story after the next. And that's when, you know, I mean, I was already building women's community in Singapore. I'd already launched Connected Women in Singapore. I was doing things like Startup Weekend and all that there. The startup scene was just starting to emerge in Singapore, I think around 2010, right? So we were doing all sorts of things. But at the back of my mind, this problem was bothering me. Like, why are these Filipino women still in this situation? And that's what, you know, that's what really like kind of sparked my passion, or not even passion, like a kind of calling, if you like, to come back.
That is amazing. Now let's take our last break, and when we come back again, we have that calling. But how did you go from calling into action? Of course, building Connected Women to what it is now, and what you've technically done right after you decided that it's time to go back home and fix this problem. Let's talk about that more after the break.
Hey Hustlers, it's time to talk business once again, and we're excited to share a bit more info about our sponsor, Sprout Solutions. And again, just like what I said at the start of the episode, you should check out Sprout's Payroll Starter as you grow your own startup. Because this bundle that they have is literally what you need to take your startup to the next level as you grow your employees. And this bundle is your key to freedom, including payroll outsourcing to experts, a subscription to timekeeping and attendance software, and government compliance services. Sprout's Payroll Starter has you covered for payroll, BIR, SSS, and taxes, all the stuff that no founder loves to do. So let Sprout handle the busy work and say goodbye to lines and tax payment stress. All this for as low as 5,000 pesos. Again, that's just 5,000 pesos all in for your payroll and HR needs. So visit sprout.eh payroll-starter-monthly-5k, or again, just click the link in the description box of this episode to elevate your business management game. And again, big thank you to Sprout Solutions, liberating your time for what truly matters. Hey Hustlers, wish there was an easy way to open a bank account and grow your money without the hassle of lengthy application process and income documents? Well, I got good news, because today's sponsor, Uno Digital Bank, is here to help you achieve your financial goals. You can easily open an account with the Uno app in just 5 minutes and one valid ID. And as one of the 6 digital banks licensed by the Banco Central ng Pilipinas, the company is committed to providing customers with simpler, better, and more accessible banking. Last year, Uno Bank was recognized by the Asia Banking and Finance Awards and bagged the title Open Banking Initiative of the Year due to the success of its partnership with GCash, one of the Philippines' leading mobile wallet platforms. And with the Uno mobile app, you can access an hashtag Uno Ready Savings account and enjoy daily interest crediting. With their hashtag Uno Earn or hashtag Uno Boost Time Deposit accounts, you can enjoy a high interest rate of up to 6.5% per annum. Enjoy monthly payouts with hashtag Uno Earn and flexible tenors with hashtag Uno Boost. Other app features include pay bills, the Uno Virtual Debit MasterCard, life insurance, scan and pay with QRPH, and phones. And the one thing that I really love about Uno Digital Bank is they're open to collaborate with a lot of Filipino startups. I've had a chance to see the partnerships that they've had lined up with the startups that they have, and it's truly exciting to see how a digital bank like Uno can enable startups to unlock the power of fintech through digital banking. So if you're ready to elevate your banking experience, download the Uno mobile app today from the Google Play Store or App Store. Or if you want to collaborate with them, I'll be happy to give you an intro. Just shoot us an email at hello@huffleshare.com. Hey Hustlers, I hope you're having a great 2024 so far. As you know, a lot of startups had a very challenging 2023, and hopefully things are going to do better this year for a lot of us.
not just because it's the year of the dragon, but also because our sponsor, DragonPay, is here to help your startups process payments in the most efficient way. Established in 2010, DragonPay empowers businesses of all sizes to accept and disperse payments through secure and convenient channels, giving your customers the flexibility to choose the payment method that suits them best. With over 85 partner channels, 35,000 partner branches nationwide, including QRPH, e-wallets, crypto, buy now, pay later, and many more. They also process an astonishing 15 million transactions processed globally each month. DragonPay is your trusted choice for online payments. And here's something to show you how legit DragonPay is. DragonPay was named FinTech of the Year at last year's Philippine FinTech Festival in 2020. So let's make 2024 extra prosperous for you and your startup in this year of the dragon. For more details, head on over to dragonpay.ph. That's dragonpay.ph. Trust the pioneer. Trust DragonPay. And we're back with a break. We are still with Gina Romero that told us that, okay, you can go far from home, but home will always draw you back because the problem will always exist. Again, Filipino women, social mobility, right? If you're lucky, you get to get out of the rat race or the generational trap that people get into, which is, you know, they don't maximize their things. And then, you know, the cycle goes over again, poverty on poverty on poverty and poverty. But I want to understand why you had to take action. Because again, you could have taken another crazy ride having another, again, FA journey, because you're very well equipped with being an entrepreneur as well. But what is it about women, and especially in the Filipino lens, that made you really want to take this on full-time? And then how did that turn into Connected Women?
Yeah, so there were a couple of things happening. One is that I could see that these women were leaving the Philippines because they just didn't have an opportunity at home. And in fact, my own yaya, right? She was a widow. She left her husband had died when her kids were so young, and she had no choice in her mind than to go to Singapore. And you know, when she joined us, she hadn't been home for like 8 years. Wow. So these kids had spent 8 years of their young life. I know. I said, Beth, please, can you go home and see your sons? Like, I will send you. And she said, no, ma'am, I just want to save every penny for the education. That was the last straw for me. I was like, oh my God, I can't. You know, and many stories like that. But I was advocating since I was in the Athena Network in the UK. And then when I launched Athena Network in Singapore, I was already advocating for women to use technology, first of all, so that they could have more flexibility in their life. And then I was also advocating for remote work, like using technology so you could work from anywhere. Because remember, I was flying. Right. So I was logging in from, you know, remotely from hotel rooms in wherever in the world and printing off invoices in my office in the UK and you know, running some of the business while I was flying. So I was like, you know, use technology, embrace technology. So that was my kind of advocacy. And then when I went, after I launched the Athena Network in Singapore in 2013, I decided to launch something specifically for women in technology. So that's why we launched Connected Women. And the tagline, it was like the super unsexy tagline you've ever heard. It was like driving technology adoption by women-led businesses and startups.
But it was straightforward and you get it right away.
Mm. My taglines are still kind of unsexy unless someone else does it. So we had partners like Google when we were at the Athena Network, Twitter, LinkedIn, Microsoft, like they all partnered with us in Singapore because they wanted to grow their female user base of their products, right? So that was happening. And then on the other hand, I had started hiring Filipino women freelancers to support me in this business because it wasn't really very profitable. It was more of an advocacy. So I needed help, right? Like, and I couldn't hire people in Singapore and all the rest. So I had like my writer, my social media manager, my assistant was in the Philippines. And then people kept asking me like, where do you get all these amazing Filipino women? Can you help me get someone?
Got it.
So the initial job idea was like, oh, I can marry these problems together, right? I can build a job matching platform, match all of these women in my network who need help with something that can be done online, and then give jobs to women like Beth so they don't have to leave the country. It was a good idea in theory, but it was misguided in many ways. Like I didn't quite get it right.
But it was noble, though. I mean, that was such a legit problem that you had to do. And again, the proof was in the pudding. you're already maximizing and the results are there. But I want to understand, right? So now you mentioned that this is really a business, because most people, again, I thought this was a non-profit that what you guys run. But I want to understand the business model of how this is a business, but still its social impact is indelible right there.
Yeah. So, well, the only reason why we were non-profit is because we weren't making profit. in the beginning. So we can all call ourselves non-profit, right, in the beginning. But I always wanted to, I really believe in the social enterprise model, the for-profit social enterprise model. Like, I don't think that we should have to separate the two. You know, I just spoke at an event with 60 young women leaders from the region. Uh-huh. And at the beginning, when I stood up, I said, we're a for-profit, you know, social enterprise. I said, I introduced ourselves and I said, yes, we are for profit. I said, how rude. We have the audacity to do good and, you know, and make money. And some of the ladies came up to me after and they said they really like that, you know, perspective. But why do we feel embarrassed about making profit, right? Like, you can do good and you can make profit as well. So, yeah, we've always been set up like that. But it was just figuring out how to make the money. That was the tricky bit, right? Because our model, like, community models are very hard to monetize. I think that's the reality. And a lot of community builders will attest to that. Like, how do you make money on a community model without monetizing your community, if you know
Makes
what
sense.
I mean?
Yep, totally understand. But okay, when that said, again, this is, if it wasn't making profit and you've already been running this for 5 years and 7 months, right? And you even double down and move all the way back here. I want to understand the logic of how you were able to get that done and still continue to actually support, because at one, there needs to be cash flow. There needs to be sustainability in order for you to get this done, because you cannot sustain a community if you yourself, you're not able to sustain the machine that allows you to do that.
Yeah. I mean, we're ambitious commercially, right? We actually see ourselves more of a startup model. Like, we want to build something that works and scale it. And potentially exit, right? You know, bring investments and platformize eventually. But how do you, you know, how, what are you building and what are you selling and who's your customer and all that stuff? So we always knew that we wanted the women to benefit, the women who need jobs, who need upskilling and all the rest. But we didn't know what we would sell, right? We didn't know what our product was. So initially, it was a job matching platform where entrepreneurs can go in the platform, you know, look through profiles. We even had some AI built in. This was like 2018 when we launched the beta. And then they could match to Filipino talent, right? And I think that model was good. But the problem with that model is it didn't solve the problem that we had set out to solve. Because when we started getting the initial matches coming through after we launched the beta platform, we noticed that the women who were actually successful in getting jobs were the ones that were the most experienced, well-educated, you know, had an amazing CV and all the rest. So the women who we really wanted to help, coming from less advantaged sectors, less experienced, less educated, they weren't getting even a chance to get the jobs, right? Mm-hmm. So we realized that the model was kind of broken. And also, it's very hard to scale a two-sided marketplace. It's very capital intensive, right? So, you know, we were raising angel funding and we were trapped in that, you know, not enough traction, but no money to really, like, you know, grow it. But when the pandemic hit, I was so frustrated that the solution that we built was not going to solve the problem that we wanted to solve in helping those less advantaged women, that I really wanted to go back to the drawing board. So around 2019, before the pandemic, actually, I'd started looking around, like, what are the jobs that you can teach people that, you know, people that really that don't have the skills, don't have the experience, but they can learn it and they can get a chance, right? The first opportunity. And I came across some interesting business models from other parts of the world, like Africa, India, where they were upskilling people even from slums in skills for data annotation and then bringing them into these types of jobs, right? So I thought maybe this is something we can do. So that's how the current model of Connected Women works. So this is a good business model now, I can confidently say, because we have clients like the Aboitiz Group, you know, the LDT Group, and then their business units, and they give us projects, and then we basically operate kind of like a BPO, if you like,
Makes sense.
We provide a managed service and we prepare the data, and we have international clients as well. So right now we're getting inquiries about self-driving cars quite a bit, and
ooh.
drone annotation. Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's fun work.
I want to understand, again, before you got to this level where, again, finally you figure it out that also you brought in the right team, what were the hardest parts? Every single startup has to go through that.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my God. This
so
is
so much.
That's why. Yeah, well, why
there's so many, know. Right? Mm-hmm. So the first hardest part was like the job matching platform wasn't scaling. We had so many people looking for jobs. That's how the community grew. Like so many people were looking for jobs and we didn't have the jobs. Like we couldn't even market ourselves to entrepreneurs globally to let them know that we had this talent pool. I mean, we didn't have the funds to do the, you know, the expensive marketing activities, like the really good ones. So we were bootstrapping marketing, right? Which was reaching out to people on LinkedIn, cold messaging them, a bit of social media, a little bit of ads, a little bit of SEO, but never enough of anything to drive enough volume to make money, right? Because each match is like a couple of $100. So it's not, right. It's, you have to get the scale to be sustainable.
Right.
So that was really hard. But I think for me, the hardest thing was when I realized that what we built wasn't solving the problem. And it's really awkward to go back to your co-founder, to go back to your angel investors and say, you know, we spent all this time and money building this job matching platform. I want to scrap it. Oh, I want to scrap it and do something else. And they're like, what do you want to do? And I was like, AI. And this is 2020, right? They thought I'd lost it. So I think I sounded like a crazy person. And, you know, they had to take a real bet on this idea. But now, fast forward 4 years and everyone's talking about AI everything, then now people are starting to get curious about what we're doing and starting to make a bit more sense, I think.
That's amazing. Now, all right. Again, that's always that being able to get over that hump. But how did you make that dynamic work? And I love that you have the humility to say that, you know what? I can't do this alone. I need to bring in fellow amazing women, because I've had a chance to interview Agnes here before. And again, amazing job that she's done in MDI in Novare. But I want to understand how you had that epiphany. Like, all right, I need to get these people. And how did you even pick them to be the co-founders, trudge you on so that you can pack a better punch?
Yeah. So when I came back to the Philippines and I had zero network and I've never lived in Metro Manila and Bobby had been out for like a couple of decades, right? So the first thing I did was, you know, I just said, I want to meet amazing Filipino trailblazers and I want to interview them for my website, for my blog. So someone introduced me to Ruth and among others. And when I sat with Ruth, we had tea for like 4 hours, I think.
Wow.
We just talked and talked and talked. And she was very fascinated with the idea of helping women because Ruth does a lot of outreach work and a lot of like community work and a lot of community service. Like she has such a big heart, but she hadn't thought about doing it like this, right? Like finding a way that they could empower themselves more. Or maybe she hadn't come up with an idea. So she was very fascinated with the idea that we could teach them skills or give a platform and then women could basically, you know, get access to opportunities that way and help themselves, right? So, you know, she said, how can I help you? And I said, well, in every way, like, I don't know how to start up a company. I don't know anyone. I need some funding. So Ruth was very instrumental at that point and was a catalyst, you know, for Connected Women to get launched. So she opened up all her networks, all her, you know, expertise, helped bring the money. So that got us, and she, you know, we fundraised up to about almost $600,000 USD.
Whoa,
during that period of time.
That's amazing.
Yeah, just on the back, you know, just quietly on the back end with angels. But most of that went to like building the platform and, you know, trying to build the demand side. Mm-hmm. When we pivoted to the data annotation, we were starting square one again, right? We went back to the beginning. I mean, it's still the same organization. We didn't change the company, but in reality, it's a completely different business.
Right,
now.
Right.
So we started with the training. So we have two revenue streams. One is training, where companies will fund scholarships. And nice. Then once those ladies are trained, we then deploy them on projects. And then that's our other revenue stream. So it got to a point that by end of 2022, we'd already validated and nice. We were starting to get like bigger, you know, slightly bigger contracts and we wanted to scale it up. And I said to Ruth, actually 2 years before we got Agnes, because we got Agnes end of 2020, I think it was end of 2023. Yeah. 2 years before, I said to Ruth, when we scale this, we need to get a CEO because I'm not a scaler, you know, as a CEO. I think I can lead the innovation and the ideas and come up with product ideas and solutions, but I'm not the person to, like, as Agnes would describe it, put all your ducks in a row. and that's her. So that's obviously, and timing was perfect. I mean, Agnes was finishing up at MBI. It was actually Myla who suggested that we speak to her.
Wow.
So I didn't poach her from Myla, FYI. If anyone thinks that I would be crazy enough.
How did
you
get that done? Hey, that's amazing. So it's Myla who actually suggested that you got her. That's amazing. Now again, Miss Agnes is one of those girls that are like, okay, you, Ron, you better act straight. You're going to get whooped, right? You're going to get whooped. She has a big girl energy, right? But it's a loving mom, big girl energy. How does that dynamic work? Because you're all alpha women, right? How do you work?
Yeah.
And of course, there's going to be friction. There's going to be alignment. But how do you make this thing work?
Yeah, I think the first thing is, like, we're all very different. And I think we're all mature enough. I mean, we're all entrepreneurs in our own right. You know, we're all leaders in our own right. So we've all had quite a lot of different experiences under our belt. And I think at this point, we all know our strengths. And so we complement each other very well in that sense. Like, there's hardly any overlaps. I mean, Ruth is the deal maker. She's the one who you bring in if you need to get bring a person and get them to, like, invest in you and all of that stuff, right? And Agnes is the person who will make sure that, you know, all the compliance is done, all the operations are run smoothly, that the contracts are properly done, and that everything can scale. And I'm the person who sits in the sort of back room with Bobby and a few others and sort of just ideates about things that we could do and does more experimental work. And of course, I love the impact side as well. So I think just because we're so different, it works very well. But I think it's really important if you bring someone in to lead that you're able to let go of leading, right? Yeah. So I was very conscious. So when Agnes came in, I said, I report to you, right? I'm the founder, but I'm, like, head of special projects. I didn't even want a C-level title.
Wow.
So, you know, I said, I'll report to you, and because we need one person who's in charge, right? Because I read about bringing in a CEO, right? And most of the problems happen because you bring in a CEO, but the founder still is the CEO.
Doesn't want to step aside.
Yeah. And I didn't want that to happen. So I said, I will step back and I will take your guidance as to the areas that you want me to sort of get more involved in. And so it was pretty smooth.
Wow.
I mean, obviously there are areas where I probably get too involved again because I forget that I'm not in charge, but we're candid with each other, right? Like, I'll just say, sorry, I overstepped. That's your area. I will leave you to it.
Yeah.
And I think it's difficult for the team as well, right? Because they're used to me being there. So I have to keep reminding the team, like, nope, ask Agnes. Agnes is in charge. And of course, they were worried. The team were a bit worried. They didn't voice it out so much. But of course, when you say, I'm bringing in a new CEO, but I'm not going anywhere, it's fine. They're all a little bit suspicious as to what's going on, right? But I think now they realize that what we said was happening was what was actually happening.
That is amazing. Now, just a few questions before I let you go. Again, the super duper amazing dynamic. But what's your advice for these people? Again, social, there's still inequality. There's still a lack of opportunities for women who, of course, especially in the tech realm, for them to maximize. What would be the first step? Because there's a lot of people, like, again, there's a lot of women who's in the freelancing space already. But again, there's a lot of mismatch and oversupply in certain things, and there's a big gap that needs to be filled. What's your advice for women to take advantage of the opportunities in tech?
Yeah, so, well, AI is a massive, massive thing, right? I mean, I don't think we're prepared as a society, as a country, or as a humanity for what disruption AI is about to bring. And I'm not saying that in a doom and gloom way. I just, you know, we're going to go through a massive shift because of AI and the mainstreaming of AI. So, you know, and right now we lack diversity in tech, especially gender diversity. Well, not just gender diversity, but also gender diversity. And we don't have enough women getting involved in decisions around AI, even if they're not AI experts, right? Like, getting involved in their industry and voicing out their concerns and talking to people in their industry that understand AI. I think we really need a lot more voices in general in the AI space, but especially women, because otherwise the people building the tools are not designing them and developing them for, you know, half the audience, right? So I really, really am pushing and encouraging women to stay up to date and get involved in the AI space and just use the tools, right?
Sounds good. Now, all right. What's exciting about the AI realm now, considering that, again, there's this ethical AI, I think that's what you call it, that that you want to maximize. And yeah, I guess we're at a tipping point. And I think humanity is taking a certain direction that if we continue to trudge on and being part of the AI movement early on, making chatbots as my business, right? I contributed a bit towards that movement, but what does that even mean in this realm where ethical AI and how to use AI properly in the realm of doing new ways to work?
Yeah, so I think the challenge with any kind of technology, right, or innovation is that we don't have a good track record as humans in regulating something before it's rolled out, right? Mm-hmm. We've always retrospectively tried to fix the mistakes that we've made. And I think it's kind of ambitious to think that we can do it any other way, because it's hard to regulate stuff that you don't really understand, right? Mm. You understand it when you're already using it. So I think, you know, it's a really tricky space, because on one hand, we're rolling out all these innovations and it's amazing, right? We're using ChatGPT, we're using like all these different tools, yep, and it's changing the way that we work. But on the other hand, you know, like, where did this data come from, right? Mm. What data exactly is in there? How is the new training data that we're putting into the system going to be used? And then there's so many ethical considerations, like copyright issues. Have you seen this new Suno app, right? That it can make any tune you want just from a text prompt. You know, where did it get the training data to learn how to make music, right? So there are so many things, but I focus on two areas of ethical AI, which are the areas that I understand probably better. One is making sure that the human component, you know, the workforce component, because most of us know, but not everybody knows, that all AI is trained and overseen by humans, right? And this industry, the data annotation industry, has such a bad reputation because it's, you know, it's been like companies have basically exploited vulnerable groups to get this data training done. Sorry, yeah. AI training done. So, yeah, you know, one of my core advocacies right now is really on ethical supply chain, focusing on the workforce. Like, how do we make sure that these vulnerable people are actually treated properly and not exploited? And then my other advocacy is really about diversity in tech, because if you look at any of the big AI companies out there, right, the biggest ones, if you look at their boards, you will see probably majority white, male, Western people, right? And so that means that what they're building is really designed for people in their sphere. And that doesn't necessarily include us in Asia, and it certainly probably doesn't consider women. Well, we know it doesn't, because a lot of the things that are going wrong are affecting women. So I'm excited about it, very excited about it. I think we're going to see solutions that we can, that, you know, to problems that we've had for decades. But on the other hand, we need to be careful and we need to be aware of what's happening.
That is absolutely correct. And again, thank you very much, Gina, for such an amazing, amazing episode. But before I let you go, again, invite people over if they want to work with you. Again, start connecting with women and, again, working with the whole team that you guys have. What's up next for you guys? And if they want to work with you, where do they go and how do they do that?
Yeah, so we're really scaling outside of the Philippines now. So we're focusing on the bigger AI markets. So if anyone's listening that knows,
there's a lot
companies,
for sure. Bobby's listening.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. Anyone who's building like AI models, and you need to make sure that your training data is clean and well prepared, and you care about working with ethical companies that take care of their workforce, then reach out to us. And of course, the Philippines as well, right? There's a lot of digitization and AI innovation happening. So. And that, of course, upskilling.
Yep, right. Upskill there. And again, well, you have to, this is a, you have, we're coming at a point where there's massive upskilling that to happen. But again, Gina, thank you very much. But before I let you go, follow us on whatever podcast app you're listening to, whether Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if we did say some jargon, it's going to be the show notes on hustleshare.com. If you also want to support Hustle Share and doing content like this, you can check it out and subscribe and help us out at premium.hustleshare.com. And again, thank you very much, Gina.
Thank you. See you, Ron. We finally did it.
Woo. Yes, we did. And I'll see you guys in the next episode. Peace.